the Moen Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Twitter fact checks a Trump tweet. Now the president plans to push back with an executive order. We'll hear how a 24-year-old law may change the social media landscape. Plus, NIMBYism, or not in my backyard, often limits action on homelessness. But one Hollywood resident not only opened up his backyard, but his home and his life as well. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. All right, during the show, we're going to be talking to a pediatrician about how parents can approach the reopening up of Los Angeles with kids in tow. What are the best practices when it comes to children, big and small? Plus, we'll hear what it's been like to give birth during the pandemic. That's all coming up in about 20 minutes. But we start today with an eye on Silicon Valley. Earlier this week, Twitter made the unprecedented decision to start fact-checking tweets made by President Trump. Now, that move was quickly condemned by Republicans, claiming that conservative speech has been stifled on the platform. Well, today, the president channeled that indignance into an executive order aimed at a law that has protected tech companies for nearly 25 years. For more, let's talk to Kat Zakreski. She reports on technology policy for The Washington Post. Kat, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. Now, this executive order is directed at the Communications Decency Act, specifically Section 230. First off, what is Section 230?
So Section 230 is a decades-old legal provision that gives tech companies broad legal immunity for the content that people post on their platform. So basically what this provision does is it says that the comments, photos, posts that you and I share on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, the tech companies themselves can't be sued for what we post.
Now, the executive order that President Trump is planning on, what does that do?
So according to the drafts that we saw earlier today, that executive order would direct the Department of Commerce to petition the FCC to open a review of Section 230 and how the law is being applied. This executive order would also direct the Federal Trade Commission to begin investigating whether or not the tech companies' content moderation decisions violate some of the public promises that they've made about their political neutrality.
And also federal agencies would have to think about how much they're spending on social media, too?
That's exactly right. They'd have to take a closer look at their social media advertising spend.
All right. So we've got the two sides squaring off. So theoretically speaking, Kat, how would a website such as Twitter be affected if, say, Section 230 is changed or even dismantled?
So companies like Twitter and Facebook have built an entire business on people posting freely on the internet. And these companies are very concerned that if they were to face litigation or lawsuits for the content that people are posting or the decisions that they're making about removing content or moderating content, they could be buried in legal fees that could make it impossible or very difficult for them to operate. And, you know, they also warn that, you know, while Facebook, Google, these companies have massive coffers, large legal teams can deal with this threat, it might be particularly difficult for up-and-coming new startups to deal with the increased threat of litigation that any change or rollback of Section 230 could open up.
I mentioned earlier how Twitter went to the first time ever fact-checking a tweet by President Trump. But typically, what do they put maybe limits on Twitter?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Each company has different policies and community standards around how they moderate content. And there are certain areas of topics that are particularly sensitive for these companies. And in the wake of the 2016 election, a lot of companies have adopted really strict terms of services and policies about spreading misinformation about the voting or election process. You know, after all the fears about election interference on these services, they've come out with stronger policies and said, hey, you can't share misleading or false information about the voting process. And so that's why we saw Twitter this week take action against the president's tweets that were suggesting that mail-in voting was fraudulent. And so, you know, there's a couple other areas where we've seen Twitter start to label misinformation on its platform. Another area is coronavirus misinformation. You know, in the past, tech companies have been really hands-off with posts from world leaders. They say that these posts are newsworthy, and so they tend not to moderate them. But we saw some companies actually remove posts from the president of Brazil. We've also seen the companies get a little bit more strict when it comes to altered media that might be hard for the public to distinguish. So actually earlier this year, we saw Twitter label a tweet from White House official Dan Scavino that President Trump had retweeted for being a manipulated video of former Vice President Biden. So we are seeing, you know, as the companies have been under this pressure, particularly from Democrats, to take greater responsibility for content on their platform, we've seen them cracking down a little bit more in these categories of misinformation.
So potentially this executive order, Kat, could result in tech companies needing to exert more control over posted comment. I mean, isn't that a good thing that, you know, there's a lot of false, hurtful things posted every day on social media? So it sounds, at least on the surface, that it could be a good thing.
You know, it's a really interesting point, because this law, Section 230, is extremely controversial, and it's a rare issue where you hear Trump talking about rolling it back, and actually former Vice President Joe Biden has said that it should be revoked altogether. So this is a law that both Democrats and Republicans have problems with. On the Democratic side, they're concerned that the law protects, gives the companies too much protection, that basically they are able to, you know, allow any content to be on their site, so they aren't doing enough to fight falsehoods or terrorism or other problematic content. On the Republican side, you're hearing the total opposite, that, you know, they think that this law is allowing the companies to censor too much because it's preventing them from bringing lawsuits against the companies for any content moderation decisions they make as well. So I think, you know, there's a lot of people who see Section 230 as problematic and do want to see some reform to it. But I think, you know, those same people who want the tech companies to take greater responsibility for content might find what the president did today as fairly problematic, because it seems like he is, you know, threatening regulation at these companies in retaliation for them, you know, marking false information on Twitter.
Yeah, it seems like the president doesn't like to be fact-checked. So I would imagine that if this thing goes through or gets changed, then they actually will have to, you know, add more editorial control, that he might not like that would kind of backfire the whole point of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just like speaks to how thorny this issue is for Trump. Right? I mean, he's one of the biggest Twitter users in the world, but also one of the company's biggest critics. And it was really interesting today at the press conference where he was talking about signing the executive order. You know, he suggested that he would like to delete his Twitter account, but mentioned how useful social media has been for him in getting his message directly to the American people, especially as he calls, you know, the media fake. And so I think really, you know, what we're seeing here for the president is this is an issue that can rally the base in an election year. It's kind of an extension of what we hear him saying around media bias. He's now just extending that to social media bias. And so, you know, I would expect that this kind of executive order sets up a couple more months of debate about that issue as we get closer and closer to November.
One more thing, Kat, I can already hear and see the legal challenges to today's executive order. What have constitutional lawyers said, and is legal action likely?
I think legal action is extremely likely. There are a lot of constitutional experts that we've heard from today, particularly from the ACLU and other organizations, who have questioned the constitutionality of what the president is trying to do with this executive order. And, you know, my colleagues have reported that some tech companies are already discussing how they could potentially challenge this in court. So I think, you know, this is really just the first chapter in this saga, and it's going to be a debate that rages on for some time.
Kat Zagreski reports on technology policy for The Washington Post. Kat, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
All All right, though the local economy is starting to open up, it may be quite some time yet before we can hear live music again, or maybe even see a comedy show, or really catch any kind of live performance. The kinds of venues where people cram into a space to be entertained and amused are part of Phase 4, the last phase of Governor Gavin Newsom's reopening plan, and some may not be able to last until then. Mark Flanagan has owned Largo, currently at the Coronet Theater in Los Angeles, for 27 years. While the club has been closed for more than 2 months, he's part of a team trying to get more support from the federal government to save places like his. The group's called the National Independent Venue Association, or NIVA. Mark Flanagan, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here, Mark. Now, Largo has a history in L.A. going back some 30 years. But for those who may not be familiar with it, tell us about it and what kind of a club it is.
It's very local. So it doesn't depend on touring and acts from on the road. So it's very much built up on local talent. It's kind of very much a community that we've built because of Sarah Silverman and John Bryan and Patton Oswalt. And some of the people that have performed, that still perform, have done it for many, many years. And it harkens back to maybe in the 50s and Central Avenue, where the jazz clubs, where there was residencies by artists.
Mark, what's it been like to be dark for so long for you and your staff?
It's very strange. I really want to do something to help other people who need help. And I feel like now more than ever, that opportunity is very hard to attain. There's a lot of people doing online things and stuff like that, but it's frustrating, but it's also I'm up for the fight. We closed on March 11th, so it's almost 3 months, and it's not getting... It doesn't seem to get any better. They're like everybody. We're having peaks and valleys at our house. You know, one day we're like, this is marvelous. And about 20 minutes later, it's like, when will this pass, you know?
Yeah. I know the trade publication Pollstar forecasted an $8.9 billion loss for venues across the U.S. if places remain dark until the end of the year. What's that hit been for you like, Mark?
You're talking about $300,000 that is just not generating. We pay our artists based on the ticket sales. And 95% of our shows sell out. We give 60% of the money to the artists. So there's that revenue that's lost to the local artists, young artists like Moses Storm and established artists like Margaret Cho and Sarah Silverman. And that income is gone. But then personally, with the staff and with the other expenses that I have, it's up definitely a few $100,000 within 3 months.
Talking to Mark Flanagan, owner of Largo, currently at the Coronet Theater in Los Angeles. Now, Mark, you helped launch this group, NIVA, National Independent Venue Association, in association with the hashtag Save Our Stages. Tell us about NIVA and what you and your fellow members hope to achieve with it.
I closed a few days before Gavin Newsom, you know, enforced a lockdown, but we were the first to close. And according to his phase four, or the national phase four, will probably be the last to reopen, along with sporting events and stuff. And so independent venues, like, you know, I'm a sole owner for 27 years, and the Troubadour, we own our businesses. And so we're looking for support to, you know, with this enforced closure, to compensate us somehow so that we can keep this going and support our local artists. So if and when we do reopen, we're not hit with insurmountable bills that just cripple us immediately. Largo's not nationally that famous, but, you know, the Troubadour certainly is and stuff. And so I think it's also my goal is to represent all the venues, whether they're well-known, famous or not. And realizing, too, that my interest in getting people on stage is way behind the national racism and the national homeless situation right now. So I realize that people might look at this and go, well, you know, but I'm thinking about down the line.
But it's an expression of art, Mark. I mean, people need that in their lives. At least take away some of the attention to all of the bad news. I'm wondering, Mark, you know, we mentioned how your venue, as most other venues, are in phase four of Governor Newsom's reopening plan. If you factor in all the logistics, do you agree with it being in phase four? Should it be in an earlier phase?
To be quite honest with you, I don't want to risk any customer or any performer. And recognizing that if we're to believe any of these people, that Anthony Fauci or Dr. Fauci is saying that there's a very strong indication that this will come back in the fall. The least interesting aspect of all this is opening and reclosing to me, or exposing anybody to anything. So I stand by where I felt 2 months ago, which is like, it's not really worth opening unless we have a vaccine. It feels in the last few days that it's an escalated push to reopen the economy. And I do understand the fiscal side of things, but these milestones like 100,000 national deaths and 100,000 cases in California alone, I just don't want that on my plate, that, you know, one of my staff members who has a pre-existing condition gets taken down by this thing. And so if I can avoid that, I will. But I also do recognize that the phase opening of or phase four opening, which would be social distancing, that's just not going to work for a lot of us, you know, where it's like a capacity. If you have 275 people, we measured it out, there would be 56 people can fit in my venue.
Would Largo be able to hold on for a vaccine?
I don't think so. But bear in mind, like, just take the history of the Troubadour. I only found this out because I applied for a beer and wine license 12 years ago in a little room next to the theater. And it turned out it was the original Troubadour that Doug Weston opened in 1957. And they declined his beer and wine license. And then he went, okay, well, you know what? I'll take it up to Santa Monica Boulevard. What I'm saying is that, like, I started Largo in 1993. I was there for a year, but in a predominantly immigrant Jewish area of Fairfax that was very run down. I'll pop up somewhere. Absolute 100% confidence that with the community that we have, I'll be able to do this somewhere. If it's not at the Coronet Theatre, it'll be somewhere. But some of the other venues that have shareholders and stuff like that, I really don't know. I mean, you know, and the Troubadour in particular, like, they rely on national touring. And from what I'm understanding from friends that work at the touring companies and William Morris and all these different places, they're talking a year away for that infrastructure to really take, you know, to get back in the saddle. So I think there will be a thinning of things, but I think creative people will find a way, and I certainly will find a way.
Mark, one last thing. What would the mark on Los Angeles be if they cannot hold on and they go away?
You know, I grew up in the 70s in Belfast, and so this is not strange to me to be in a lockdown or to be in adversarial, hostile environments, but I do believe it will pop up. I have 100% confidence that I will pop up as Largo. But some of those other infrastructures, I really don't know. And I think it will be a big scar on the community if they don't somehow reach out and try to save some of these places. And I know we can't save all of them, you know, and also just because of financial, because some of the partnerships that own these might be frayed already, you know. So it would be dark days if these great venues don't reopen.
That's Mark Flanagan, owner of the Largo at the Coronet Theater in Los Angeles. Mark, thank you very much and good luck.
It was a pleasure. Stay safe.
All right, California is slowly but surely opening up. And as we all start to emerge from our shelter-at-home biodomes, you know, creep out of our parent caves, most of us will have those little critters, our kids, right next to us. All right, so now what? What do we do with them? How do we keep them safe and, maybe even tougher, keep them entertained? Well, you've got questions. Lucky for you, we have an expert with answers. That expert's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. Yesterday, LA County released a framework for reopening schools, and Mayor Eric Garcetti told us he would like to open more rec centers for kids this summer. They're among the steps being taken toward easing stay-at-home orders and reopening the region, but reemerging from our quarantines can be a little trickier with kids in the mix. So for a little guidance, we reached out to Dr. Tanya Altman. She's a spokesperson for the American Academy of Pediatrics and a pediatrician based in Calabasas. Dr. Altman, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure. All right. Now, can you give us a quick recap of what the county has advised?
Sure. So LA put out a very extensive plan. I was actually fairly impressed reading through it myself. It's very long on exactly what each of the schools needs to be able to accomplish in order to reopen this August. And otherwise, they will have to do distance learning, or as I believe many of the schools will go to, is a hybrid approach of partially on-campus in-person learning and partially at-home learning. And these include, you know, depending on how many students they can fit in the classroom, can they control traffic going in and out with everybody physically distanced? Will they be able to do health checks such as temperature checks, have enough PPE for the teachers, enough disinfectant and sanitizer? And will they be able to safely serve lunches and be able to transport the kids in that do need to take the buses?
Dr. Altman, you're the school physician for Viewpoint School. You've also been providing schools across the country general guidelines based on CDC, WHO, and American Academy of Pediatrics, and your own plans for the schools you advise. How does the county's guidelines match up with what you've been advising?
So even though you have all these various groups around the country and even around the world, you know, working on their own plans of how to safely reopen schools, there are a lot of common threads that we see through all of these plans. The way that I usually divide it up is I say there are three problems that all schools are going to need to tackle. And the first one is, how do you keep the virus from entering the campus? And this is going to be with the staggered drop-offs and the temperature checks and the health screenings. And then how do you keep the virus from being transmitted from person to person at school? And this is where you get into the spaced out desks and the masks and the frequent disinfecting and the hand washing and the kids staying in small groups in one classroom while the teachers move from class to class and try not to have very many groups mixing with each other. And the third, which in some ways can be the hardest one, is what happens when a student or a teacher gets sick. As it's not if, unfortunately, it is going to be when, as we know that we are going to see illness when everyone goes back to school. And so then it is, how are you going to identify them, isolate them, and test them, and then also contact trace? And the contact tracing is really going to be key. And this is why it's important that you know where every child is every hour or minute of the day. And that's why you have to have assigned seatings and small groups of kids that don't mix with all of the other students. So
that sounds difficult, doctor. I'm sorry. That's not knowing where every kid is every second of the day. I know that's their job, but my gosh, that sounds tough.
About it in school, you do know where the kids are. You know what classroom they're in, when they're moving from class to class, where they're having lunch, and they're going to be a little bit more controlled than in past years. I mean, this is a new normal school day. It's not going to be a regular school day. You're not going to have hundreds of kids running around having lunch together. They're going to go in small groups at special, you know, spaced out times throughout the day. And this is going to be important that the administration does keep track of all the children, because we have to know when somebody gets sick, who have they been in contact with. But the one major difference I've seen with all these plans is the distance that students or desks need to be around the classroom. Mm. And so the CDC and this LA County plan uses 6 feet, which is what we all think of when we talk about physical or social or the new term healthy distancing. However, if you look at the WHO plans, it's pretty clear there that 3 feet or 1 meter, as they use in Asia, is enough as long as the kids are masked and the surfaces are disinfectant and they're all washing their hands. And I actually think that 3 feet or 1 meter is going to be enough and much more practical to getting more kids in each classroom. So I personally feel that by the time kids go back to school, that WHO guidelines are going to be the norm. But we'll have to wait and see.
We're talking to Dr. Tanya Altman, pediatrician based in Calabasas. Thing is, if parents, or actually if teachers knew where kids were every second of the day, there would be no need for detention, no need for going to the principal's office. But you know, we'll see. Now, wondering, doctor, as a pediatrician, what do you think schools need to buy or maybe have in place in terms of maintaining cleanliness? Does maybe every student and staff member need to have their own personal kit of masks and wipes? I always load down my granddaughters whenever I take them to school. I make sure that they have Purell.
Yes, and I think that's a really important point. And the school districts and the schools are going to have to start stocking up on these supplies now, because as we know, many are back ordered and in short supply. So all of the schools are going to need way more cleaning supplies than they've ever dreamed of using. And these are solutions and sprays and wipes that actually disinfect or kill germs, specifically the COVID-19 virus. Some schools are going to have to purchase those defoggers to use to clean in the evening if they don't already have them. All of the teachers and kids are going to need their own PPE. So either we're going to be giving out reusable face masks to everybody to use, or they're going to have to bring their own. If you look at Asia, there they are having the kids change their masks during lunchtime. So every child will bring 2 masks with them in the morning to school, just as you would your lunch in your backpack. You put one on in the morning, or you arrive in it, and then you take it off for lunch, because clearly you can't eat and drink with a mask on. Wash your hands and then put a clean mask on after lunch. You'll take them both home if they're reusable, have your parents wash them out to bring them back the next day. And if they're disposable, then you can simply throw them away.
Now, as we head into the summer, no scheduled class time, no camps, really any youth services that are really available right now, parents might find themselves really at a loss with what to do with their kids. Doctor, any suggestions?
So right now, the most important thing you can do with your kids is really just spend time with them. I mean, when have you had a summer with nothing else going on? Especially the younger kids, they are so loving the fact that their parents are home every day. And this is time that you're never going to get back. So I always tell parents, when all of this COVID-19 craziness is over, what your kids are going to remember is how they felt during this time. Did they feel safe? Did they feel loved? And the memories that they created with you. So try to spend time with them. Read books. Go for scavenger hunts in the neighborhood and look for leaves. Build forts, play board games, run through the sprinklers. Now, summer is a long time, so I would say get everybody in your house together and come up with a schedule. You know, ask your kids, what do they want to do this summer? And, of course, there is going to be disappointment for all those things that you couldn't do, right? They couldn't go to camp. You couldn't go on a family vacation, so you're going to have to acknowledge that and say, you know what, my mommy's really sorry that your camp was canceled or that we can't, you know, drive to Yosemite this summer. But these are some things that we can do, you know, in our local neighborhood. And let's talk about what we want to accomplish. And then don't forget also to, you know, to bring education and learning into whatever you're doing this summer, because kids normally go through this kind of like, you know, summer slump where they maybe, you know, don't learn as much and it's hard when they start school. Our kids have now been out of school for so much longer than that. So try to create learning in whatever you're doing. You know, they can study or learn about their favorite sports hero or about the bugs in the backyard. You know, whatever it is that they like, that's fun. Just make it educational and enjoy the time together.
That's Dr. Tanya Altman, pediatrician based in Calabasas. She's been advising schools across the country on reopening practices. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Moving on, pregnant women make up a small fraction of the people who've tested positive for coronavirus in LA County. And while experts don't know the full effect of the virus on pregnancy and babies, KPCC's Mariana Dale reports new safety precautions are changing the process of birth.
Alhambra couple Sheila Thomas and Charles Lyles knew the birth of their second child would be different because of coronavirus. For example, their hospital would now only allow one support person in the delivery room.
My mom, she did not care that it was COVID time. She was going to try to break down the hospital door to get to me, but I convinced her to stay home.
And then during a routine prenatal visit on May 7th, several days before her due date, the doctor told Thomas her amniotic fluid was low.
And she looked at me and she said, "You're not going home. We're inducing you." And then I flipped out. And so I said, "Let me call the doula who can listen to what it is you're saying and then tell me later when my mind is clear."
They dialed Monique Cowan. She's been supporting people before, during, and after birth for almost a decade and almost always in person. Now she coaches clients on the phone from her Hawaiian Gardens apartment.
I'll be walking around and like my voice has changed. I'm louder or like I'm whispering and like she's hearing me breathe and moan because I'm mirroring my client.
Cowan guided Lyles as he used his hands to massage his wife's sacrum and glute muscles to relieve some of the pain of labor.
Since he wasn't there, you know, she inspired me to do it, to help her out, which helped me feel like I was actually being useful.
Cowan works with African-American moms through a county program that aims to reduce the disproportionately high rates of Black maternal and infant deaths. Since the onset of the coronavirus, she says families' fears of childbirth complications have gotten worse.
Feeling like you're going to be by yourself in a hospital where, you know, you're already hearing stories and statistics about Black women not being treated well is very scary and anxiety-inducing.
She's not the only one who's noticed the increased stress. Researchers like Darby Saxby are studying how soon-to-be parents are feeling during the pandemic.
We know that stress during pregnancy can have potentially profound effects on infant and child development. From looking at smaller birth weights or more risk of preterm birth,
Saxby is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Southern California. She's investigated the transition to parenthood for years. When she compares recent surveys to her existing research, she sees more signs of depression and anxiety in pregnant people and their partners in LA.
People are feeling like they're getting less support from their families and from their community networks. So I thought that these differences were really, really striking, considering that the pandemic's only been going on for a relatively short time.
And that stress doesn't always go away after the baby is born. Part of the reason Sheila Thomas sought out a doula was because she experienced postpartum anxiety when her first son was born.
I'm actually a licensed clinical psychologist, and the postpartum anxiety snuck up on me like a thief in the night. When it hit me last year, I didn't even know that's what was happening to me.
Her mind raced with uncontrolled thoughts.
I'm the only one who could keep this baby alive. Nobody else will be able to keep this baby alive. So that means that I have to stay awake all the time. I cannot sleep. Other people, they might let him die. For real, they probably want him to die. Honestly, like, it goes that bad.
This time around, she's more aware when her mind tumbles into that tangle of anxious thoughts.
I still have thoughts like I'm the only one that can keep him alive, but now I can say that's unrealistic. There's other people here.
Thomas has built a network of support, including her husband, family, a therapist, and her doula, who for now is a text message or phone call away. Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
All right, with more parts of California slowly but surely opening up, one of the measuring sticks for clearance is infections, the number of infections in a particular county. But how is that measured? How does the math exactly work? So say someone is in prison, they're infected, but they're not getting out anytime soon, so they're isolated in that space behind those walls. Do they count in terms of the total population and also in terms of opening that region up? Well, one area in California has decided not to add up these people that are behind bars. We'll find out how that's going over when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Say goodbye for the summer. Darling, I promise you this, I'll send you all my love every day in a letter sealed with a kiss. Guess it's gonna be a cold, lonely summer, but I'll feel the
back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. California counties looking to ease lockdown restrictions have to prove that they haven't had a COVID-related death in 14 days. That's one of Governor Gavin Newsom's strictest conditions. Now, as we know, prisons across the country have been devastated by COVID-19 outbreaks, so counties with infected prison populations are facing what they feel to be an unfair additional hurdle. Abby Van Sickle covers criminal justice in California for the Marshall Project. She joins us to talk about how Santa Barbara County has been reopening its economy despite a massive COVID outbreak in the Lompoc Federal Correctional Complex. Abby, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, first off, how many of the COVID-19 cases in Santa Barbara County can be attributed to the federal prison in Lompoc?
So from the last figures that I saw, it's roughly 65%. So it's a substantial number of the cases in Santa Barbara County.
Now, when did the virus outbreak in the prison happen?
So the numbers really started to explode in early May. And by May 15th, roughly 1,000 of the prisoners at that facility had tested positive.
Okay, so how is Santa Barbara then planning to move forward in spite of this outbreak right in their county?
The officials there had wanted to be able to move into the next stage of reopening, which includes things like opening some shopping centers, some dine-in services at restaurants, that sort of thing. But they had this prison outbreak, which was preventing them from meeting the governor's requirements. And so they asked to not include the prison numbers, and that's for people who are incarcerated, in their application to the state to start reopening.
What was their justification for not wanting to count the prisoners?
So officials there say that the prisoners are concentrated in one area and not able to move about the county, and that they also, when and if they are released, will not be returning back into Santa Barbara County, but coming back to the places that they are, that they're from or where the offenses were committed. And so they wouldn't just be, opening the gates and letting people just out into Santa Barbara. So officials there are treating it as if it's a pretty isolated place that's separate from the county.
We're talking to Abby Van Sickle, covers criminal justice in California for the Marshall Project. It almost sounds like they're kind of making these people not exist. They do exist, but in their eyes, it's kind of like they don't exist.
Well, the staff at the prison are coming in and out of the facility. Yeah. And when I spoke with a number of criminal justice advocates, including the ACLU, which has sued that prison for what they say is mismanaging the outbreak there, lawyers there said that, they called it somewhat of a fiction to say that the prisoners are somehow separate from the rest of the people in the county because staff are coming in and out. They're not actually, isolated away from the rest of the public. However, county officials take a really different view of that and say that they believe that they have, enough precautions in place that the general public isn't at risk from the prisoners.
Abby, why is containing COVID inside prisons so difficult? I get that physical distancing is probably hard for obvious reasons, but why else?
So you're correct in that social distancing is really difficult in prisons. And there are also a number of other things. Some of the facilities that have been most affected are places where the population inside, they're older. They have serious medical conditions already, making them a vulnerable population. Prisons also have restrictions on things like hand sanitizer, which can have alcohol in it, as well as cleaning supplies. The basic things that we are all learning as a society to use to combat this virus are things that are very difficult to come by inside.
Abby, you mentioned how staff are going in and out of the prison all the time. I'm wondering, what's the protocol right now for prison staff in Lompoc?
Yes, so the prison staff are being monitored for symptoms. And I did speak with the mayor in Lompoc, and she was telling me that many of the staff live in the town or in the immediate area. And that for her, it's a really difficult equation because she said she believes in the importance of giving people hope that, opening the economy where you can. But she's also deeply concerned about infection spreading in the community.
Prisons account for many COVID hotspots around the country. So with counties maybe leaving prisons behind, so to speak, I mean, what incentive is there to contain the virus, if any? Is that one of the problems that we're facing right now with this?
That's something that was raised when I spoke with criminal justice advocates and, lawyers who are suing the prisons, is a concern that by not including prisoner outbreaks in county numbers, does that take off some of the political pressure to really do something about the conditions inside?
One last thing, Abby. I'm wondering if ignoring prisoners at this time is just kind of like the latest example of how prison populations are excluded and ignored by the world around it. I mean, what does that say about us as a society when we do that?
I've talked with a lot of families of people who are incarcerated in state prisons in California as they have watched numbers tick up in their facilities, particularly in the Chino facility in Southern California. And the thing that I've heard is just a concern that their loved ones will be forgotten about, that, maybe their loved one did something that was wrong or they did something that they should not have, but they are paying their price in their sentence and it shouldn't be a death sentence. That is something that I've heard again and again from family members, to remember what's going on inside the prisons and that their loved fathers and sons and mothers who are inside and are fearing for their lives right now.
That's Abby Van Sickle. She covers criminal justice in California for the Marshall Project. Abby, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, local leaders, political and otherwise, say they care deeply about homelessness. They offer angry, emotional pleas for people to step up and do their part. But see, the thing is, often that's where it ends, with words, not actions. One Hollywood resident, though, took action by taking in a homeless man for 2 years and then putting the experience into words. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Loving you so.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Angelenos have made it clear they care about homelessness. Pre-coronavirus, at least, it was the number one issue for many residents. And they backed it up by voting for things such as Measure HHH, taxing themselves to pay for solutions. But that's in the macro sense. In the micro, it can be complicated. Seeing a homeless person, interacting, and then inviting him into your home and making part of your family, well, that is exactly what Michael Koenig did. He lives in Hollywood, above Sunset Boulevard near Fairfax. His book is The Unexpected Guest, How a Homeless Man from the Streets of L.A. Redefined Our Home. We talked with him last week and started by telling us about that homeless man, Fisher King Mike.
Fisher King Mike was one of the regular denizens of our neighborhood who you would see at the bus stops, who you would see wandering around Sunset Boulevard. And I got to know him because he was fond of joining the open mics in our neighborhood. He would come in there, put his name on the list, and perform. I got to know him as a gentle poet, a man of letters, and also an incredibly colorful and, let's say, unusual individual.
Yeah. Okay. So you did know him at least a little bit, because I'm wondering what went into you deciding that you'd invite him into your home? Because even though you knew him, you don't really know the demons that he's dealing with, demons that could someday become your problem.
Yeah. It forced us to decide, what kind of human being are we dealing with here? And my wife Charmaine and I decided that Mike was, by many definitions, mentally ill, but we also had a very strong sense that he wasn't aggressive, he wasn't violent, and he wasn't a drinker. His weirdness was not dangerous. And the process of actually coming into our home, it took several weeks. He actually didn't start living in our home. He basically asked, could his bags stay on our front porch overnight? We agreed to that to try to be helpful. A few days later, he wondered if he could crash with his bags on our front porch. My wife and I discussed it and said, well, man, if we let the guy keep his bags on our front porch, why wouldn't we let him sleep at night on the front porch? And it went from there.
Michael, most people won't even let the bags part of this happen. I mean, they wouldn't. And some people would actually call the cops. See, I know that you were a professional poker player, gambler. How much of those blackjack poker skills did you lean on to make that gamble on Mike? Because I have to read it that way, that this was a gamble either way anyone looks at it.
We just sort of looked at it as, we see what's happening to our beloved city. What we call the homeless problem is actually a humanitarian crisis. And our decision there really wasn't like a cost-benefit analysis or risk versus reward. It was more like, okay, look, we can talk a good game about wanting to help the homeless and wanting to volunteer and just wishing we could do something. But at the end of the day, what can we, two people who don't have much to offer except just a little extra space, what can we do?
Wow, that's amazing that you went that far. What did Mike wind up doing for you?
Mike actually healed himself while he was in residence here, and he went from being a person who strongly believed he was married to Selena Gomez, a person who strongly believed he owned a private jet, to the caretaker of our property.
Caretaker Mike is what he wound up calling himself, too.
That's what he called himself, yeah. And that's what everybody ended up calling him. We found out that this so-called crazy man was wildly talented with tools. And he decided that, look, you guys have been taking care of me so beautifully. You live in a 100-year-old home that's falling apart. Let me be the caretaker of this place. And so we sort of built a beautiful symbiotic relationship of taking care of each other.
Now, how did your neighbors react to Mike being around? Because, Michael, you know, while Angelenos are concerned about homelessness, NIMBYism has been a huge issue when it comes to the idea of homeless people living in specific communities. So how did your neighbors around you feel about having Mike live with you?
They were skeptical. They were curious. But I want to also give them great praise. They had known us long enough, and they had known all the sort of idealism that we try to put into action to know that our hearts were in the right place. And we had some conversations. We made sure that they met Mike. We made sure they understood his brand of weirdness was not threatening. And eventually, to my great delight, Mike ended up doing handyman projects for many of the people in the neighborhood.
We're talking to Michael Koenig about his new book, The Unexpected Guest, How a Homeless Man from the Streets of L.A. Redefined Our Home. You mentioned that Mike claimed that he was married to singer Selena Gomez, who he says he had a couple of kids with. He was a street pastor, according to him. Also, as you said, performed special ops for the Department of Defense. Did you ever find out the real story of Mike?
Partially. Mike had a medical crisis when he was with us, and when I took him to the hospital and they plugged in his Social Security number, for the first time, Charmaine and I discovered his real birth date.
And Charmaine's your wife.
Charmaine's my wife. Yeah. And we then found out that he was 20 years younger than we had assumed the entire time. He had told us he was a Vietnam vet. He had told us he was 63 years old. And based on the way he looked, you would believe him. That was shocking. Now, once I had his real information with birth date and Social Security, I did as much research as I could. And I found out some very interesting things. But the real, real story, the one that I really wanted to know, how did this beautiful man end up with his wings so damaged he could no longer fly? That story, we never actually got the answer to.
Wow, because I think, Michael, when anyone, you know, walks around L.A., drives around L.A., I'll just speak for myself on this, and I see someone that's on the street, I always wonder how they got there. What circumstances in their life caused them to wind up where I see them? And, you know, obviously, I don't stop, and I'm sure a lot of people don't stop to ask these questions, but that's what makes me think about this problem in these huge terms, that it didn't happen overnight. Something had to happen at some point to lead him to the streets.
Yeah, A. Martinez, how do many people end up on the street? The stories are varied and full of terrible bad breaks, but the bottom line is somewhere along the way, there was some kind of crisis, abuse, trauma that they never quite recovered from. In the case of Mike, he alluded to a very bad childhood. He alluded to the fact that he was raised by his grandparents. But what actually happened to him, he never wanted to discuss.
Did you and your wife think that you could love Mike into him getting better?
Originally, no. And originally, that wasn't our goal. But after a little while, seeing how much being needed and being useful to a community changed things. Like just the fact that he was no longer invisible and useless to his society, that seemed to change everything. And once we recognized that, we learned that, maybe with love and compassion, maybe things can be healed.
Michael, you did something that 99% of people who say they care about homelessness would never, ever be able to do. And I could not help but feel, as I was reading your book, that you had a sense of guilt for having what you have in life. Was I reading that right?
I think that's close. And I don't think it's a guilt for what I have. I think it was a little bit more a kind of realization that I may say how grateful I am, but really, deep down, do I behave in a way that reflects how much appreciation I really do have for everything? The more I was able to be generous and the more I was able to give, the better I felt about myself.
Now, after 2 years, Mike decided to leave your home. What became of Mike?
I don't want to give away the ending. I would like to leave that for readers, but I do want to assure everyone that Mike is well. He is not back on the streets, and that he has not spiraled down to some inescapable pit where he can't be rescued. He is well, he is housed, and to me, it's a happy ending.
All right, we'll have to read the book. Michael Koenig's new book is called The Unexpected Guest, How a Homeless Man from the Streets of L.A. Redefined Our Home. Michael, thanks a lot.
Hey, Martinez, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for your interest.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, it's a good one today. Good one today. Just head wherever you get your podcasts there. We will be waiting to be heard by you. And meanwhile, if you love Take Two, love KPCC, why don't you give? Just go over to kpcc.org and give to your heart's content. We would really, really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.